I want you to start off today by trying a little thought experiment with me.
Oh, I love these.
Right. So close your eyes, or I mean, just let your focus soften if you're driving right now.
Yeah, please keep your eyes open on the road.
Exactly. But I want you to imagine your body positioned exactly how it is right now, only it's floating a few feet in front of you.
Okay, kind of like an out-of-body experience.
Exactly. Just suspended there in a void.
Hmm.
Now, in your mind's eye, watch a translucent bubble form around that floating body, encasing it completely.
Got it.
Take a deep breath, and as you exhale, realize that you are no longer the body inside that bubble.
Wait, so where am I?
You have actually become the surrounding darkness. You are the outer boundary itself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you are the vanishing point of perspective. You're a view from somewhere that appears as nowhere.
That is an incredibly disorienting cognitive shift to try and pull off.
Isn't it?
Yeah, because you are essentially asking the mind to locate itself in a non-existent space. You're trying to, like, look at your own looking.
Disorienting is the perfect word for it. And that deeply uncomfortable feeling of claustrophobia, of realizing you are trapped inside a perspective that you can never actually step outside of, well, that's the entire foundation of what we are unpacking today.
It really is.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. It's Tuesday, March 31st, 2026, and we are embarking on a journey through just a staggering piece of work.
Staggering is honestly an understatement.
Yeah, we're diving into a massive 31-paper compendium titled The Imagination Machine, authored by Mark Tracy.
This compendium is a monumental text. Like, our primary mission for this deep dive is to explore what Tracy calls a unified formal framework for embedded epistemic systems.
Which I know sounds like impenetrable academic jargon right out of the gate.
It totally does, but it basically translates to a very fundamental, very human question,
Right.
which is, how do we actually know anything when we are permanently trapped inside the universe we're trying to observe?
Because that's the rub, isn't it? We have no view from nowhere to check our answers against.
No answer key at the back of the book.
Exactly. Like in school, you take a math test and the teacher has an answer key. If you write down four, the teacher looks at the key, sees four, and says you possess the truth.
Right, because there's an external standard.
Right. But when we are talking about reality itself, like gravity, the nature of light, or the existence of other minds, we can't step outside the universe.
No, we really can't.
We can't look at some cosmic answer key and say, ah, yes, physics works exactly how I thought it did. We are stuck inside the bubble.
And that constraint is absolute. And what makes this 31 paper series so remarkable is that it doesn't try to cheat that constraint.
Not at all.
It starts as this relentlessly rigorous mathematical epistemology. I mean, we're talking equations, set theory, dynamical systems, math,
Yeah.
very heavy, building from the ground up under the strict rule that we are trapped. But miraculously, by following that strict mathematical logic, it
He
evolves.
really does.
It turns into this sprawling, beautiful exploration of human history, artificial intelligence, the structure of morality.
And eventually it lands on geometric theology of all things.
Which is wild.
It's the ultimate bait and switch, but in the best possible way. Like you sit down to read dense math, and by paper 31, you're looking at the stars, wondering about the geometry of the infinite.
Yeah, it takes you on a real journey.
So what we're going to do today is map the absolute boundaries of our own minds. And I can pretty much guarantee that by the end of this deep dive, you are going to view your own acts of learning, your daily choices, and your deeper beliefs differently.
You'll see them not just as psychological quirks, but as unavoidable geometric necessities.
Okay, so to get to that point, though, we have to start by completely accepting the trap.
Right. The trap of the embedded observer.
Tracy's foundational rule is that an embedded system can, at most, classify the ways in which it classifies the world entirely within the world itself.
Wait, let me just pause you there. Classify the ways in which it classifies the world. That sounds like a snake eating its own tail.
It basically is. It's a recursive loop, which is why it's so hard to visualize. Because we cannot access the universe from the outside, knowledge cannot be defined by correspondence with some independently accessible objective reality.
Because there is no external vantage point to correspond to.
Exactly. Like if I say the apple is red, I can't check that against the objective universe's definition of red.
Right.
I can only check it against my own visual processing system and, the collective agreement of other trapped observers.
Okay, so if external correspondence is impossible, Do we just throw out the idea of objective truth?
That's the fear.
Because that feels like a recipe for total chaos. Like, if I can't know anything objectively, then how do I know a bus is going to hit me if I walk into traffic?
But the framework doesn't throw out knowledge. It just redefines where knowledge comes from. It argues that knowledge must come from internal coherence, not external correspondence.
Internal coherence.
Yeah. And to achieve this, Tracy introduces what he calls the inference implication loop. This is basically the engine of the entire imagination machine.
Okay, let's walk through this engine because the math here is actually surprisingly intuitive once you map it out.
Yeah, it has four distinct steps. Let's start with step one, observation.
Right. You observe data generated by interacting with your environment. You touch a hot stove, your nerves fire. That's raw data.
But raw data is useless on its own. It's overwhelming. So the system moves to step two, which is compression.
Okay, compression.
You compress those raw observations into an internal world model. The mathematical term Tracy uses here is creating a quotient representation.
A quotient representation. Let's ground that for the listener. What does that actually mean in plain English?
Think about the mathematical concept of a quotient, like in division. You are reducing a complex fraction to a simpler form.
Okay, that makes sense.
In cognitive terms, you're keeping the relational invariants, the core structures that stay the same, and you are actively dropping the redundant, chaotic details.
So to compress observations is to represent them by imposing a conceptual boundary. You're deciding what matters and discarding what doesn't.
Exactly. So if I'm looking at a forest, I'm not perceiving every single leaf fluttering in the wind, or the exact angle of every branch.
Or the microscopic movements of the bark.
Right. My brain compresses all that chaotic data into the quotient representation of tree.
Precisely. You have bounded the chaos.
Yeah.
But a model is only useful if it can do work.
Right. Which brings us to step three, extension.
You use this compressed model to predict the future or to fill in missing relations in your environment.
You assume the tree will still be there when you turn your back.
Or you assume the branch will hold your weight if you climb it.
And then reality happens, which is step four, the update.
The crucial step.
Yeah, you use the prediction errors from your new observations to revise your compression. You step on the branch, it breaks. Your prediction was wrong.
The raw data of falling forces your brain to update its internal model.
Okay, branches of that thickness cannot hold my weight. And then the cycle starts all over again. Observe, compress, extend, update. It's a relentless, nonstop churn.
And the critical moment in this framework is what happens when this loop finally stabilizes.
Stabilizes how?
Let's say your model's predicted observational profile perfectly reproduces itself over and over. You stop falling out of trees. Reality stops surprising you on that specific frequency.
Okay.
When that happens, the system reaches a mathematical fixed point.
A stable closure.
Yes. This stable closure is what functions operationally as knowledge.
Operationally, not objectively.
Right. It is vital to understand that this fixed point is not you possessing an ultimate objective truth about the universe.
It's just your specific way of encountering the world proving so incredibly stable that it survives the recursive loop without generating prediction errors.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy because visualizing this loop changed how I think about my own memory.
Oh, definitely. Let's hear it.
Imagine you wake up in a pitch black room, no light whatsoever. You have no external view of the room's layout.
So the ultimate embedded observer track.
Exactly. You take a step forward and absolutely smash your shin on a coffee table. It's excruciating.
Ouch.
Right. The pain in your shin is the observation. Now your brain does the compression. It creates a mental map saying there is a solid knee-high object in this specific spatial coordinate.
A quotient representation of a hazard.
Yes. Then comes the extension. You predict that if you swing your leg in that exact spot again, you will experience pain.
So you adjust your path.
Right. You walk around it. The next time you walk through that part of the dark room, if you don't hit the table, your map has reached a fixed point.
Because your prediction was correct.
Right. You didn't need to turn on the lights to see the objective truth of the table. Your internal model achieved perfect internal coherence with your sensory data. It works.
The darkroom analogy is excellent.
Mm.
But to truly grasp Tracy's framework, we need to introduce the crucial mathematical twist here.
Okay, hit me.
In your analogy, the coffee table feels like the real thing. But to an embedded epistemic system, the coffee table itself isn't what is real.
Wait, then what is?
What is real to the system are the relational invariants.
Meaning the distance between my shin and the pain?
Exactly. The consistent, measurable relation between your action taking a step, and the sensory consequence, which is the pain.
So my brain doesn't actually know what a table is.
The system doesn't know what a table is in any metaphysical sense. It only knows the stable geometry of the interaction.
Wow.
And Tracy connects this dynamic directly to the philosopher Karl Popper's theory of conjecture and refutation.
Popper, he's the guy who basically defined the modern scientific method, right? You can never prove a theory true, you can only prove it false.
That's the one. In the imagination machine framework, your extension operations are your conjectures. They are your hypotheses about where the table is in the dark. The prediction error. The sharp pain of hitting the table when your mental map told you the path was clear acts as the mechanism of selective elimination. The error forces a representational revision.
So science isn't the process of discovering objective facts. It's just the process of slowly mapping the relational invariance of the dark room by repeatedly bumping our shins and updating the map.
That is the tragedy and the triumph of the embedded observer. We can build magnificent, highly predictive models of the universe, but we are always just mapping our own interactions with it.
Man. Okay, if I follow this logic to its natural conclusion, if learning is just updating this loop, making our quotient representations tighter and more accurate, then getting smarter should make the world feel smaller and more manageable, right?
You would think so.
Yeah, if I map more of the dark room, I should feel more secure. I should be surprised less often.
It feels like common sense that knowledge reduces uncertainty. But the mathematics in these papers proves the exact opposite is true.
Right.
Yes. This brings us to one of the most counterintuitive and brilliant concepts in the entire series, the paradox of refinement.
Okay, I actually struggled with this part for hours. The math dictates that refinement, the act of learning and creating a more detailed model, actually increases expected surprisal.
It increases your cognitive entropy.
How on earth does knowing more make us more surprised? It feels completely backward.
To understand why it's not backward, we have to look at how Crazy defines refinement mathematically.
Okay.
Refinement is the act of creating a finer, more detailed mental partition of the world. Imagine your world model is a sorting system. When you're a child, your sorting system is very coarse.
Like broad categories.
Right. You look at a field and see animals. Every creature you see gets tossed into the broad category of animal.
So my probability of being surprised is very low. Because no matter what walks out of the woods, a dog, a deer, a bear, I just say, yep, that's an animal. It fits my model perfectly.
Exactly. You have a massive probability mass assigned to a very small number of broad categories. But as you learn, you refine your model. You split animal into mammal, reptile, bird. Then you split mammal into canine, feline, bovine.
You're getting more specific.
Yes. You are diluting your representational density. By knowing more specific details, you are creating far more discrete, tiny spaces in your mental map.
And because there are more tiny spaces, the odds of any new observation fitting perfectly into the exact right tiny space goes down.
That is the mathematical core of the paradox. A finer partition assigns lower probability mass to each specific class.
Oh, I get it now.
Yeah. If you are a dog expert and you have categorized 80 different specific breeds of dogs in your mind and a strange mutt walks out of the woods, there's a mix of three breeds you've never seen combined.
Your highly refined model fails to categorize it instantly. Your prediction error spikes.
Yes. The mathematical surprisal value of that event is drastically higher for the expert than it is for the child who just sees dog.
So learning doesn't actually eliminate uncertainty. It just gives us a higher definition, like 4K television, on which to watch the uncertainty play out.
When you slice reality into tiny, hyper-specific categories, the spaces where the unknown can manifest multiply. Refinement formally expands a system's capacity to be surprised.
Think about this in your own life. I bet everyone listening has experienced this. Have you ever started learning a new subject? Maybe you picked up a new hobby like photography, or you started reading about quantum physics, only to feel like a month into it, you know less than when you started.
Oh, absolutely.
Like when you bought the camera, you thought, I just point and shoot. But then you learn about aperture, ISO, shutter speed, focal length, color grading.
And suddenly you're paralyzed.
Yeah. Every time you take a photo, you're paralyzed by how many things could go wrong. The more you zoom in, the more you realize you don't know. That feeling of overwhelm, that is literally the math of the imagination machine at work. You are paying the surprisal cost of refinement.
It is exhausting. Epistemic refinement burns cognitive calories.
It really does.
And this exhaustion leads to a critical structural feature in the text. It's an equation written as C is a subset of D, which translates to the inclusion condition.
Okay, the classifiers are a subset of the observation space. Let's translate that out of math. What does it actually mean for my daily life?
Well, if a system is genuinely an epistemic subject, meaning it has the capacity to doubt its own thoughts, much like Descartes did with his famous, I think, therefore I am, then its own evaluative processes must be observable to itself.
Meaning I can watch myself think?
Right. You aren't just categorizing dogs. You can observe yourself categorizing dogs. You can ask, why do I care about dog breeds?
Okay.
Because we can doubt our own thoughts, our classifiers, our values, and our choices are located inside the observation space. We are part of the dark room we are trying to map.
Which introduces a terrifying infinite regress. If I'm observing my own observing, where does the loop stop? What makes the final call?
That's the million-dollar question.
And this is where Tracy introduces a concept that I never expected to find in a rigorous mathematical proof. He leaves room for, and mathematically defines, will.
Yes.
He argues that the will is the irreducible remainder of the entire epistemic loop.
And this solves a massive philosophical tension that has plagued cognitive science for decades.
How so?
The inference implication loop, this cycle of compression and update, determines the space of all possible stable closures. It gives you the menu of valid world models that perfectly fit the data of your life.
So, like, if I get fired from my job, my loop can generate a few stable models. Model A, my boss is a jerk and had it out for me. Model B, I was actually underperforming and need to improve. Both models might perfectly fit the raw data of the firing.
Exactly. The loop provides the valid menu. But the math of the loop does not, and structurally cannot, determine which element from that menu is actually instantiated in your mind.
So the math doesn't force my choice?
No. Will is what selects a specific closure in a territory that no model can ever fully exhaust. The equations don't explain away your agency, they frame it.
Wow.
Willing is what remains when the computational loop has done absolutely everything it can do. You have to choose the quotient representation you are going to live inside.
And that choice brings us to the dark side of this geometry.
The really dark side.
Yeah. If learning is mathematically proven to increase our capacity for surprise, and surprise is cognitively exhausting, then it makes sense why so many people just stop learning.
It's just too tiring.
Right. Tracy defines dogma here not as a personality flaw, but as a mathematical defense mechanism. Dogma is the absolute refusal to pay the surprisal cost.
It is the rejection of refinement. A dogmatic mind is one that maintains its internal coherence, not by genuinely absorbing new observations, but by forcing new anomalous data into old existing categories to avoid the mental cost of updating the world model.
They just bend reality to fit their map.
Exactly. It holds its coarse partition fixed.
It's the ultimate cognitive laziness. Instead of saying, wow, this new data point contradicts my worldview, I need to do the exhausting work of tearing down my mental map and rebuilding it, the dogmatic mind just says, nope, that data point is a conspiracy, or that person is just evil.
They shove the anomaly into a pre-existing box so they don't have to burn the calories to build a new one.
And while we can judge that socially, mathematically, it is a perfectly valid strategy for maintaining a fixed point. It just results in a deeply fragile relationship with reality over a long enough timeline.
Extremely fragile.
Okay, so we have this incredible, exhausting engine in our heads. We are these relentless prediction machines, constantly trying to map a dark room, dealing with the heavy, heavy cost of surprisal, forced to use our will to select our reality, and constantly fighting the urge to collapse into dogma.
It's a lot.
It's a ton. Why? What cosmic force built us this way? Why aren't we just simple stimulus response machines like bacteria?
Tracy points to an origin story that is entirely naturalistic, yet feels almost mythological. He points directly to the sky above us, the earth, the sun, and the moon.
He calls it the celestial metronome, and the compendium makes a profound argument here.
Yes, that human temporal metacognition, our very ability to think about time, to plan for the future, to record history, evolved specifically because of the unique gravitational dynamics of the Earth-Sun-Moon system.
Okay, I need you to break this down, because the idea that my ability to reason is tied to the moon's orbit is wild.
It sounds wild, but think about the environmental conditions created by those celestial bodies. They provide stable but mathematically incommensurate cycles.
Incommensurate, meaning they don't sync up perfectly.
Exactly. We have the solar day caused by Earth's rotation. We have the lunar month caused by the moon's orbit. We have the solar year caused by our orbit around the sun. These three cycles never exactly align. Their relative phases are continually drifting.
Meaning they don't lock into a perfect repeating gear system. Every single day is a little bit different. The moon is in a slightly different phase on this exact calendar day this year than it was on this exact day last year. The seasons drift, the tides drift.
Precisely. Now imagine two alternative universes. Let's call them Universe A and Universe B.
Okay.
In Universe A, the environment is perfectly periodic, a locked orbit. Mm. Every single day is exactly the same as the last forever.
So total repetition.
Right. If you evolved in Universe A, you wouldn't need a complex brain. Intelligence is a waste of energy there. You would just evolve to be a thermostat, reacting to the exact same stimulus with the exact same biological response in a permanent, infinite loop.
Right. What about Universe B?
In Universe B, the environment is totally random. Pure thermodynamic chaos. No sun, no steady orbits, just random bursts of heat and radiation.
So pure unpredictability.
Yes. And in that universe, you also don't need intelligence because learning is impossible. No pattern ever holds long enough to be modeled.
But we live in Universe C, a quasi-periodic system.
Yes. A quasi-periodic environment features constant novelty wrapped inside an underlying structure. And a quasi-periodic environment acts as a massive evolutionary sieve.
It filters out the thermostats.
Exactly. It actively selects for brains capable of inductive estimation and record-keeping. Because the cycles drift, you need a brain that can hold on to a relational invariant like the abstract concept of a year or a winter, while simultaneously dealing with the chaotic, a periodic variation of the drifting phases.
You have to be able to abstract recursively nested temporal demarcations.
Mm.
Days inside of months, months inside of years.
That's the only way to survive.
So early humans are looking at the sky, realizing the cold is coming, but the moon looks different than it did the last time the cold came. They had to invent a mental model that could hold both the pattern and the deviation.
Yes, and Tracy uses some heavy dynamical systems math to explain how the brain actually pulls this off. He introduces the Koopman connection.
Right, the Koopman operator.
In dynamical systems theory, it's notoriously difficult to predict the behavior of complex nonlinear systems. The drifting multi-body precession of the planets is highly nonlinear and chaotic over long time frames.
So how do we deal with it?
What the Koopman operator does, mathematically, is allow you to take a complex nonlinear system and represent it linearly in a higher dimensional space of observables.
Hold on, you're losing me. What does it mean to take something non-linear and represent it linearly in my brain?
Okay, think of a river with rapids and whirlpools. That's a non-linear system. It's chaotic, splashing, unpredictable at the micro level. If you try to predict the path of a single drop of water, you will fail.
Totally.
But if you step back and look at the whole river, you can draw a straight line representing the general flow of the current. That straight line is a linear observable. You have abstracted the chaos into a predictable geometry.
So the sky is the chaotic river of drifting orbits, and our brains literally evolve the capacity to act as biological Koopman operators.
Exactly.
We internalize the messy relational phase differences of the planets and encode them into straight lines, linear, tractable concepts like a calendar, so we can predict when the elk will migrate or when the frost will hit.
That is exactly it. Our brains are performing advanced dynamical systems math constantly just to survive the winter.
Unbelievable.
And Tracy argues that this is why human history exists at all.
Right.
History, timekeeping, culture, they only became possible because of this drifting multi-body precession.
Because we had to track the drift.
Right. We had to invent external records. We had to paint the phases of the moon on cave walls to track the drift. We externalized our linear models because the quasi-periodic environment was too complex to hold in a single biological generation.
Which perfectly sets up the next major hurdle for an embedded system.
Which is?
Well, if our brains run this exhausting, massive inference implication loop to build linear models of a chaotic universe, every single human baby can't start from scratch, right?
Absolutely not.
I didn't have to spend 30 years staring at the moon and bumping my shins in the dark to invent the concept of a calendar. I just bought one at the store. How do we pass these incredibly hard-won quotient representations down to the next generation without making them pay that massive surprisal cost from zero?
We do it by building institutions.
Right.
This is the fourth major theme of the compendium: institutions, dogma, and the illusion of artificial intelligence. Embedded systems don't exist in a vacuum. We exist in networks, in communities that share and transmit these stable closures across time.
Tracy defines institutions essentially as mechanisms for intergenerational compression.
They stabilize knowledge and hand it down.
But he draws a very sharp, very dangerous distinction between two types of inheritance: generative inheritance and compressed inheritance.
It's a vital diagnostic tool.
And I think this distinction explains almost everything wrong with our current educational system.
It really sheds a lot of light on it. Let's break them down. Generative inheritance means a society transmits the closed profile, the facts, the world model, and the inferential machinery required to update it.
I want to use a software analogy here because it clicks perfectly. Generative inheritance is like giving the next generation a highly useful software program, but also giving them the open source code and teaching them the programming language.
Yes.
You say, here is an app that tracks the seasons. It works great right now, but here is the code because one day the climate might change and you will need to rewrite the app.
You are handing down the facts, plus the loop of critical thinking and scientific method required to revise those facts.
Right. That's generative.
Compressed inheritance, on the other hand, is transmitting only the closed profile. You hand down the facts, the dogma, the traditions, but you actively slip away or fail to teach the capacity to refine them.
It's giving them the compiled executable file of the software, locking them out of the source code and saying, just click run, never look under the hood.
Exactly. And the paper mathematically proves that a society relying on compressed inheritance becomes catastrophically fragile.
Because the environment shifts.
Right. We establish that we live in a quasi-periodic universe. The environment always shifts eventually. The planets drift. The climate changes. The economy evolves.
And when that shift happens, a society running on compressed inheritance has a mental partition that no longer fits reality. The software is glitching.
But because they don't have the source code, because they lack the generative machinery of the loop, they can't build a new model. They just frantically click run over and over as the system collapses.
They collapse into dogma to defend the broken software. And you can see this historically in empires that ossify and fall.
You see it everywhere.
But what blew my mind is how Tracy applies this concept of compressed inheritance to the most cutting-edge technology of our time.
Oh, the AI critique.
Yes. He uses this framework to completely deconstruct current artificial intelligence, specifically large language models.
It is a profound critique. There is a lot of hype right now about AI becoming conscious, or AI acting as a true reasoning engine.
But the math and the imagination machine argues that LLMs are not imagination machines at all.
Not even close.
I was initially resistant to this because when I use an AI, it feels like it's reasoning. It can write poetry, it can code, it even hallucinates, which feels like a form of imagination. Doesn't hallucination prove it has an internal model?
Hallucination actually proves the opposite.
How so?
In the terms of the four-step loop we discussed earlier, Tracy shows that an LLM is merely an isolated extension operator. It executes step three. Given a prompt, it extends the pattern based on its training data.
Right.
But it lacks the full autonomous recursive loop of compression, action in an environment, and prediction error against subsequent observation.
It doesn't bump its shin in the dark.
Exactly.
Right.
It has no shin, no dark room, and no pane of prediction error in a live environment. It doesn't update its own fundamental quotient representations through active struggle with reality.
So it has no true internal world model.
None. It is essentially operating entirely on compressed institutional inheritance.
It has ingested the ultimate executable file, the entirety of human text on the internet, but it has no source code. It has all the answers to the math test, but it doesn't know what numbers are.
Yes. The paper argues that AI's failure on complex, novel reasoning tasks isn't a scaling problem.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't going to solve it just by building bigger data centers or feeding it more text.
Because it's a structural problem.
It's a topological problem.
Yeah.
Tracy uses a brilliant concept from neuroscience to explain this. Current AI possesses what we might call place cell computation.
Place cells.
In the human brain, place cells fire to tell you where you are in a specific environment. AI knows exactly where words are supposed to be located in the high-dimensional space of a sentence.
But it lacks grid cells.
Precisely. Yeah. Grid cells in the mammalian brain create a universal metric space. They allow you to navigate environments you have never been in before by understanding the structural relations of space itself. They provide the linearizing dynamics, the Koopman operator we talked about. AI lacks this capacity to internalize structural, relational invariants to navigate truly novel, untrained conceptual spaces.
So when faced with a novel structural problem, the extension operator just keeps guessing based on past data, which is why it hallucinates nonsense.
Exactly.
Okay, so if AI, with all its massive computing power, currently lacks the true machinery for deep structural reasoning,
yeah.
What is the specific cognitive leap that allows human beings to do it?
That's the million-dollar question.
How do we jump the gap? When a human encounters a completely novel problem, how do we generate genuinely new knowledge from old knowledge?
The answer the compendium gives is arguably its most beautiful insight. It bridges poetry and topology.
I love this part.
The mechanism of true reasoning is how we use analogies.
We are moving into section 5 here, analogy, horn filling, and the structure of reasoning. Now, usually when we think of an analogy, we just think it means saying A is like B, like life is like a box of chocolates. But Tracy says that's a superficial understanding. Analogy is fundamentally deeper.
True analogy is not a direct comparison between A and B. It is mediated by a hidden third abstract domain that both A and B instantiate.
Tracy uses a classic historical example from science. An atomic nucleus is like the solar system.
Right. Let's slow down and really map this out.
Yeah. If I'm a physics teacher and I tell my students the atom is like the solar system, I'm not saying electrons are literally giant balls of hot gas. I'm not saying there are tiny little planets inside my finger.
Obviously not.
So what geometric operation is my brain actually performing when I make that comparison?
You are recognizing a shared relational structure. And to do that, your brain unconsciously constructs a hidden abstract domain.
Okay.
In this abstract domain, there are no planets and no electrons. There are only pure relational concepts. A central body, a satellite, and a relation of orbiting governed by an attractive force.
Okay, I see.
The solar system is one concrete instantiation of this abstract domain, where the central body has immense mass and the force is gravity.
Right.
The atom is a completely different concrete instantiation of that same abstract domain, where the central body has a positive charge, and the force is electromagnetism.
The analogy is the cognitive bridge built out of that hidden third domain.
Yes.
And the paper maps this cognitive process perfectly to a terrifying-sounding mathematical concept called simplicial horn filling.
It does sound intimidating.
I have to admit, when I saw the topology equations for this, my eyes just glazed over. Can you translate simplicial horn filling into something I can actually visualize?
Absolutely. In topology, you can think of a simplicial set as a collection of geometric building blocks.
Okay, building blocks.
The zero simplex is a single point, a dot. A one simplex is a line connecting two dots. A two simplex is a triangle three lines connecting three dots.
Simple enough.
Now, a horn is a partially specified shape. It's an incomplete structure.
Like a triangle missing one of its sides.
Exactly. Imagine a V shape. You have three points and two connecting lines, but the base is missing. That's a horn.
Right.
The human mind takes the known relations, the two sides of the V, and it geometrically fills the horn to complete the higher order structure. It draws in the third side to make the triangle whole.
So when I make an analogy, I have partial relational data from my source domain, the solar system, and I map it over to the target domain, the atom.
And your brain literally fills the horn to generate a complete, coherent hypothesis about how the atom works.
Yes. The compendium formally proves that human analogical reasoning is exactly this mathematical process of horn filling in a high-dimensional relational space.
Yeah. You are executing complex, multidimensional topology every single time you use a metaphor to explain a complex software bug to a coworker.
Or when you relate a new emotional experience to an old memory.
Exactly.
That is just staggering. The way we speak, the way we tell stories is just the surface manifestation of our minds running topological completion algorithms.
It really is.
And what makes this specific paper the absolute peak of the series for me is what Tracy does at the end of it, the self-demonstration.
Oh, man. It is a breathtaking piece of structural logic, almost like a magic trick.
It really is. He proves this entire concept by making the reader actually perform a horn-filling exercise while reading the proof itself.
So clever.
He lays out the theory of holons, which are holes made of parts, and he lays out the math of simplicial sets. As you read it, your brain starts to see the analogy between the math and the philosophy.
And in the exact moment, you realize they are the same thing.
Your brain fills the horn. The proof proves itself inside your mind. The act of understanding the paper is the empirical evidence that the paper is correct.
It's an elegant demonstration of the extension schema in real time.
Brilliant.
So we have now established from the ground up how an embedded system learns, how it predicts, why it builds institutions, and the geometric structure of how it reasons through analogy. We've built the imagination machine.
But a framework this comprehensive can't just stop at cold internal logic. It has to address reality.
Right, because we aren't just isolated bubbles floating in the dark.
Exactly. We are surrounded by billions of other bubbles, other embedded epistemic systems. Which brings us to the question. If my brain is constantly executing this geometry just to learn, what happens when my geometry collides with yours?
A very messy collision.
Does this mathematical framework actually dictate how we should treat each other?
Tracy argues that it absolutely does. Mm. He takes the exact same geometric loop we've been discussing,
yeah,
the cycle of compression, extension, and update, and turns it outward into moral philosophy.
He attempts to upgrade one of the foundational pillars of Western ethics, Immanuel Kant.
Yes.
So Kant's categorical imperative. For those who haven't taken Philosophy 101 in a while, Kant's rule is basically act only according to that maxim whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become a universal law.
Essentially, universalize your action.
Right. If you want to lie to get out of trouble, you have to ask, would I be okay with a universe where everyone lies all the time? If the answer is no, then lying is immoral. It's a classic for a reason. Why does Tracy think he needs to dismantle it?
Well, Kant's formulation is elegant, but Tracy uses the math of the embedded observer to show why it ultimately fails in practice.
How does it fail?
The problem with universalizing just the action is that an embedded observer can almost always contrive a hyper-specific scenario where a bad action prevents a greater evil, and they could logically will that specific action to be universalized.
The classic example is the axe murderer at the door.
Right.
If a killer asks where your friend is hiding, Kant says you still can't lie because lying is universally bad. But most people would say, of course I lie. I universally will that everyone lies to axe murderers.
Exactly. So the action alone isn't enough to judge the morality.
So Tracy upgrades the categorical imperative to what he calls the moral principle of action motivation. You cannot just universalize the action. You must universalize the tuple, the paired, mathematically linked set of the action and the motivation set.
The tuple. Let's break down the motivation set component.
The paper formally defines it as the minimal subset of anticipated consequences that are necessary and sufficient for you to take the action. That's a mouthful.
It is. Let's use the example Tracy provides in the text. A man named Carl is choosing to change jobs.
Right. So Carl quits Company A and goes to Company B. The action is changing jobs. Mm-hmm. What is his motivation set? Is it for a better salary? Is it for a shorter commute? Is it because he likes the new boss better?
To find the minimal necessary subset, you have to isolate the variables. If Carl would not change jobs for the shorter commute alone, but he would change jobs for the salary increase alone, then the commute is not the core motivation.
The salary is the necessary and sufficient condition.
Therefore, the exact tuple that must be universalized is action, changing jobs, plus motivation, increasing salary.
So Carl has to ask, can I coherently will a universe where everyone changes jobs to increase their salary? Yes, that's basic economics. The system holds. It survives universalization.
But let's apply this to something darker.
Okay. What if I manipulate someone? Let's say I lie to a customer to get them to buy a defective car. My action is lying. My motivation set is personal financial gain. I have to ask, can I coherently will that everyone lie for personal financial gain?
If everyone lies for financial gain, trust evaporates, commerce ceases to exist, and financial gain becomes impossible. The tuple contradicts itself on a universal scale.
But Tracy takes it even deeper than just societal collapse. He ties this moral test directly back to the epistemology of the loop.
Remember how he defined knowledge earlier? A world model must survive the inference-implication loop. It must reach a fixed point to be considered functionally true.
And here we see the grand synthesis of the compendium. Just as an epistemic model must survive the internal loop to be considered knowledge, a moral choice must survive the external loop of universalization to be considered good.
They're the exact same geometric tests of stability.
If an action can't survive its own loop, it's morally false. And this leads to Tracy's ultimate moral boundary, epistemic manipulation.
This is huge.
If you manipulate someone by engineering their epistemic closure, if you feed them propaganda or isolate them from new observations to force them into a dogmatic world model that serves you, you are committing the ultimate moral failure.
Why? Because you rely on your own epistemic openness, your own ability to run the inference implication loop, to survive as a conscious entity.
Right.
To universally will epistemic manipulation, to say it is good to destroy another person's capacity to learn, would be to will the destruction of the very machinery that allows you to exist as an observer.
It is a geometric contradiction. Yeah. I love that so much. It grounds morality not in some external divine command handed down from a mountain and not in wishy-washy cultural relativism. It grounds ethics in the cold, hard geometric necessity of being a conscious observer.
You literally cannot logically support harming another observer's loop without breaking the mathematical foundation of your own.
It is a rigorous defense of human dignity. And this pursuit of the ultimate universalizable truth, pushing the geometry of the embedded observer to its absolute limit, inevitably brings us to the final and undoubtedly most mind-bending paper in the entire series.
The finale.
We have mapped the mind. We have mapped society. We have mapped morality. There is only one place left to go.
The infinite.
This final paper merges epistemology, multidimensional topology, and theology into a singular concept, geometric theology.
The author opens this section by referencing an ancient medieval formula that has been debated by theologians for centuries. God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere.
For hundreds of years, philosophers and poets have treated that quote as a beautiful paradoxical metaphor, just a poetic way to say God is infinite and incomprehensible.
But Tracy does not treat it as a metaphor. He argues that this ancient phrase is a literal, precise mathematical description of a specific geometric shape, a four-dimensional hypersphere, formerly known in topology as an S3 manifold. And more specifically, it is the exact description of a 4D hypersphere as experienced by a three-dimensional embedded observer trapped on its surface.
Okay, my brain hurts already, but we have to break this down, because when I finally visualized this, it gave me chills. How can a shape possibly have a center that is everywhere and a circumference that is nowhere? It sounds like nonsense.
To understand it, we have to drop down a dimension. Let's upgrade the classic Flatlander analogy.
Okay, the Flatlander.
Imagine a two-dimensional being, a completely flat entity, living on the surface of a three-dimensional balloon.
Okay, so the Flatlander can only move forward, backward, left, and right. Up and down do not exist in their universe.
Correct. To that flat being, the surface they live on has no edge. They can walk in a straight line forever, circumnavigating the balloon, and never hit a boundary or a wall.
Because it just wraps around.
Right. In their 2D world, the circumference is literally nowhere. It doesn't exist.
Got it. Circumference, nowhere. Now, where is the center of their universe?
The center of the balloon is inside the 3D space, floating in the middle of the air inside the sphere. But the Flatlander cannot point to it.
Because pointing inward requires a third dimension they don't have.
Exactly. From the perspective of the 2D surface, every single point on the skin of the balloon is exactly the same distance from that 3D center.
Oh, wow. So to the Flatlander, the center is everywhere. Every inch of their universe is equidistant to a center they can never reach because it exists in a dimension orthogonal to their reality.
Exactly. Now, step that up one dimension to our reality. We are three-dimensional beings.
Right.
If our universe is the surface of a four-dimensional hypersphere, then there is no 3D boundary. We can fly spaceships forever in any direction and never hit a brick wall at the end of the universe. The circumference is nowhere.
And the center of our universe.
It lies in the fourth spatial dimension. Every single point in our 3D reality, you sitting in your chair, the center of the sun, the edge of the furthest galaxy, is exactly equidistant to that 4D center.
Center everywhere, circumference nowhere. That is incredible. It maps perfectly. But wait, why must the universe be this shape? Why couldn't our universe just be a giant cube floating in the void or an infinite flat plane? Why does Tracy insist on the hypersphere?
Because of the very first rule we established an hour ago, the trap of the embedded observer. Epistemic humility.
Okay.
Tracy mathematically defines the S3 hypersphere as the geometry of maximal uncertainty.
Maximal uncertainty. Because we are embedded, we can't see the whole shape, so we have to assume the shape that requires the fewest leaps of faith.
Exactly. An epistemically honest embedded observer must assume the geometry of the hypersphere because assuming any other geometry requires vantage points we mathematically do not possess.
To assume the universe is a cube is to assume you know there is an edge, which implies you know what happens beyond your vision.
Right. And to assume a flat plane with a center you can walk to is to assume a privileged objective position in the universe.
So the hypersphere is the only shape that assumes nothing other than closure. It has no privileged points. It is the maximally conservative geometric assumption for a trapped mind.
Yes.
So when the ancient mystics were meditating in caves and came up with center everywhere, circumference nowhere, they weren't just being poetic. They were perhaps unconsciously describing the mathematical limits of their own embeddedness.
They were intuiting topology.
And Tracy doesn't stop there. He takes the core doctrine of Christianity, the Trinity, and maps it directly onto this hypersphere math.
He derives a Trinitarian structure purely from the geometric relations. You have the four-dimensional whole, the containing being, that is entirely inaccessible and transcendent to the 3D surface. This maps conceptually to the Father.
Okay.
Then you have the three-dimensional cross-section, the embedded observer itself, the self-similar expression of the whole within the observable manifold. This is the immanent, the Son.
And the Holy Spirit. How does a ghost fit into a math equation?
The Holy Spirit maps to the embedding relation itself. It is the active mathematical map that connects the 3D surface to the 4D whole. It is the dynamic geometric bond between the transcendent and the immanent.
That brings a whole new meaning to the phrase made in the image and likeness of God, the Imago Dei.
Yes. In this framework, image and likeness is mathematically defined as the self-similarity of the cross-section to the whole.
Meaning a 3D slice of a 4D hypersphere carries the exact same relational structure, just instantiated at a reduced dimension.
You are not a flawed, diminished copy. You are a mathematically faithful, lower-dimensional expression of the infinite.
I am genuinely blown away by this synthesis. When you read about apophatic theology, the tradition of negative theology, defining God only by what he is not, saying God is not a body, God is not time, God is not finite, it always felt like a failure of imagination.
Like we just couldn't comprehend it, so we gave up.
Yeah, exactly. But Tracy reframes it completely. Negative theology isn't giving up. It is, as he puts it, correct epistemic behavior for an embedded observer facing a dimension it cannot enter. It is mathematically rigorous humility.
It is the ultimate acceptance of the bubble we imagined at the start of this deep dive. The bubble is a hypersphere, and we are the three-dimensional cross-section sliding across its surface, running our exhausting little inference loops, desperately trying to build internal models that match the massive, invisible geometry that contains us.
Think about the journey we just went on. We started today feeling the claustrophobia of being trapped in a dark room, trapped in a bubble of our own quotient representations.
We bumped our shins.
We learned about the agonizing mathematical cost of surprisal, and we figured out how our brains learn to draw straight lines through the chaotic drift of the sun and the moon.
We built institutions.
We reasoned through the hidden dimensions of analogy. We found a geometric proof for why we must treat each other with moral dignity. And we ended up touching the structure of the infinite.
We discovered that the restrictive rules of this trap are what generate absolutely everything beautiful about being human.
It's a profound reorientation. It shows that our limits are not flaws to be overcome. The fact that we are embedded, the fact that we are forced to compress reality, the fact that we can never see the whole truth at once, that is the very condition that makes knowledge, history, love, and morality possible in the first place.
Without the boundary, there's no shape.
So I want to leave you, the listener, with this. Tomorrow or next week, when you sit down to learn something new, a new skill, a new perspective, and you feel that sudden flash of confusion, that headache of realization that you know vastly less than you thought you did, don't run from it.
Embrace it.
Remember, that is the surprisal cost. That feeling is the literal sensation of your mental geometry expanding. Your partition is becoming finer. Don't fall back into the lazy comfort of dogma. Don't shrink your world to avoid the pain. Do the work. Let the horn be filled.
And as one final lingering thought for you to mull over on your commute or your walk, consider a tiny topological footnote Tracy drops near the end of the text.
Oh, the Taurus footnote.
Yeah. We've talked about spheres and hyperspheres, but biologically, topologically speaking, the human body is a torus.
A torus. That's the shape of a donut, right?
Yes. A continuous surface with exactly one through hole. In our case, the digestive tract running from mouth to end. We are a genus one topology.
Okay.
Tracy posits that this base biological topology actually sets a specific mathematical limit on our metacognitive depth, our ability to recursively fold our thoughts back on themselves and classify our own classifications. We are bound by the geometry of the torus.
Wait, if our physical geometry limits our cognitive recursion, what happens when we finally build an artificial imagination machine?
Not the LLMs we have now, but a true one.
With a full loop of action, consequence, and prediction error.
That is the ultimate question. What happens if we design the physical substrate of that true AI not as a genus one torus, but as a higher topological shape?
Oh, what?
Will an artificial mind with a genus two or genus three topology be capable of recursive depths we literally cannot fathom? Will it be able to mathematically peer into that fourth dimension of the hypersphere that we are permanently biologically locked out of?
Well, that is a thought that is absolutely going to keep me up tonight, staring at the ceiling, wondering what a genus three mind dreams about.
It's a wild thought.
Thank you for joining us on this massive journey through the imagination machine. Keep pushing the boundaries of your world models. Keep paying the surprisal cost. And remember, you are the boundary of the bubble.
The bubble bursts, but the geometry remains.
We will catch you on the next deep dive.